science enthusiasts. My name is Jason Zakowski. I'm your host. I'm a high school chemistry teacher, but you probably know our dogs, Bunsen and Beaker, from social media. They're the Twitter science dogs. This show takes what's best from their account, the curiosity and fun found there, and swirls it into podcast form. Every week, we take a deep dive into a timely science article and look at the research that's going on with our pets. In our Ask an Expert section, we have guests that will enthrall you with their area of knowledge. This is the Science Podcast.
Hey, everybody. I hope you're happy and healthy out there. Well, things in Canada with coronavirus are on the uptick. There has been a definite increase all over Canada in the number of positive cases, which is really worrisome. So today in Science News, we're going to take a look at a couple things that are topical in the coronavirus COVID-19 front in science. Just because for our listeners in Canada and Europe especially are seeing, after a plateau, a definite uptick. Just some fun Alberta news. I don't know if it's fun because Chris is pretty dismayed, but we had a massive winter storm last weekend. So this would have been like the first couple weeks of October if you're listening to this a little later. And we had a record snowfall for our area. It snowed 10 centimeters in one day. And it was pretty fun to see Beaker's expression and how Beaker acted with the snow, including how she used her cone because she's still on spay rest, like protecting her body from the stitches. She was using her cone as a snow plow, as a flinging machine. We might talk about that a little later. We have such a fun and exciting episode. I'm just so excited for who you guys get to hear today. So, of course, in science news, we're going to talk about COVID-19. And in dog science, we're going to talk about a really recent and topical study about how dogs perceive human faces. Our guest is the amazing Emily Calandrelli, who is a NASA correspondent and an engineer, but most excitingly, she is the host of Emily's Wonder Lab on Netflix. If you haven't watched Emily's Wonder Lab, it's so pure and so amazing. It's definitely geared for little kids. It's the episodes are really short, but it's just so exciting and so full of fun. Also, our guest in Wooer Wow is also pretty amazing. We have Gideon Kidd back from I've Pet That Dog. He is going to be helping me guest host Wooer Wow today with some trivia about space. Hey dogs, I really feel that learning about space all day can be exhausting because you don't really get a launch break. Okay, on with the show. Because there's no time like science time. This week in science news, we're going to take a look at a couple different deep dives into the realm of treatments for COVID-19. And the first one's really recent. It just came out. It's a huge study done by the WHO about remdesivir. So remdesivir is this antiviral drug used to combat COVID-19. This giant WHO study looked at 11,000 people who were hospitalized with COVID-19 in many different hospitals around the world. That's in 30 different countries. And they received four drugs. So of these 11,000 people, the four drugs they were given, one was remdesivir, one was that hydroxychloroquine, one was another anti-HIV antiviral drug called lopinavir, and interferon beta-1a. Also, some were given a placebo. Now, after they crunched the numbers and they looked at all of these different people, what came out of this huge study was that absolutely none of the drugs showed any benefit to any of the patients in reducing their death rate or the need for ventilation or the length of their hospital stay. So this is really recent. This study was put on medrxiv.org, and it's yet to be peer reviewed. So they're fairly confident their numbers are correct. It's a huge study, but there may be some things that change about it. I'll keep my eye on this, and if things drastically change, I'll update everybody on the Science Podcast. Some other studies have shown that hydroxychloroquine has been not effective at all. Same thing with this other HIV, anti-HIV drug called lopinavir. There was one study that is being cited by people who are still on the fence about remdesivir that was done by the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease that showed that people shaved 4 days off their hospital stay if they were given remdesivir. The study wasn't as big as the WHO study, And though the study done by the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases in the United States showed that there was a trend toward reducing deaths, the result wasn't statistically meaningful. There are other studies looking into remdesivir that are showing mild positive effects. So I guess the evidence is still out. We have to wait for this Big WHO study to be peer reviewed, and we have to wait for some of the other preliminary results to come in other studies using remdesivir. I guess we can say is that even if the WHO study turns out to be 100% correct, that remdesivir doesn't change your health outcome to the positive or negative, but maybe this other study is correct that it shaves off time in the hospital. At least that's something. Some of the researchers are also looking at, you know, maybe people who are given remdesivir too late, it's kind of too late for them to see any positive effect. So perhaps remdesivir needs to be given to people right off the bat. Now, can you get remdesivir in your country? I know in the United States, there was an emergency approval given to remdesivir. Remdesivir in Canada was one of the first drugs approved. So it's authorized for use in adults and adolescents. So Canadians can get remdesivir as a treatment. That's the story about remdesivir. A big study shows that it didn't do much or anything. Other studies show that it may shave off time in the hospital, but maybe doesn't do much for your overall health. There is one preliminary study coming out that does show a weekly positive correlation with health with remdesivir. So I'm excited to see what that one shows. And again, like I said, I'll keep my eyes on it. The other part of science news that I'd like to talk about with COVID-19 is using vitamins to fight off COVID-19. There's a lot of information slash misinformation out there. And I've done my best. I've looked at a couple different sources to go through what the experts say about different types of vitamins. So the one that's in the news all the time, possibly because the American president, Donald Trump, was given some of this when he tested positive for coronavirus, is vitamin D. Vitamin D is a fat-soluble vitamin that your body makes from sunlight. You can also get it from different types of food, like fish and milk products. You do need vitamin D. It is definitely part of your immune system. And any of the information about vitamin D and coronavirus has been built on previous studies of viruses and vitamin D. And when I looked at the different big studies that kind of compared, does vitamin D affect your virus defense in your own body? And it said, basically the evidence says it does if you are deficient in vitamin D. It certainly helps you with respiratory infections, but only if you're deficient in vitamin D. If you have enough vitamin D, like if you're taking a vitamin D supplement, you probably have enough. Taking more is not going to help you. In fact, it might hinder you. I mean, if you take too much, it can stress out your internal organs because it's going to metabolize it. It also, vitamin D helps the uptake of calcium. So there are people who've run into problems with overtaking vitamin D and having toxic calcium levels in their body. So just the conclusion on that, if you are deficient in vitamin D, well, you should take some vitamin D because it definitely helps your immune system. But taking extra vitamin D seems to have no impact on your body's ability to fight off COVID-19. Now, how much vitamin D should you take? Well, that's a hard question for me to say. There's an age guide and a male-female guide that you can Google this. Each country has their vitamin D charts. Also, it really depends on where you live in the world. If you live where I do in the winter, there's not as much sunlight because you're inside more. It's cold outside. You know, the sun is still shining, but not as many people are outside in the sunlight. So there's a bunch of things that go into that. And my best advice to you is if you don't know how much vitamin D you should take, ask your family doctor. Another mineral that is in the news all over the place, I constantly see people posting about this on Facebook, is zinc. Zinc is a naturally occurring mineral. You get tons of it in meat, in different types of beans and oysters. So yum, I like oysters. Zinc is always a hot seller in cold and flu season because it is linked to your immune system. Zinc helps your cells divide and grow. There is some weak evidence that right after a cold, if you take zinc supplements, it may lessen the symptoms or make your cold go away quicker. However, other studies have been completely inconclusive. A big study from Finland and the United Kingdom published in January in BMJ They didn't find any help from taking like zinc lozenges or zinc supplements or anything like that. It's just really inconsistent. So can it affect coronavirus? Researchers from Germany wrote in Frontiers of Immunology that there is evidence that zinc supplementation could help with similar infections like SARS and other types of coronavirus. It seems to reduce the risk of infection and death from pneumonia. And pneumonia is one of the things that people who suffer from COVID-19 and get some serious, have some serious effects may develop pneumonia. Pneumonia is really dangerous. Also, taking zinc supplements, if you're deficient, is going to help you too. So just like vitamin D. So unlike vitamin D, there does appear to be a little bit more evidence to show that taking a zinc supplement may help with, I guess, warding off the worst effects of COVID-19. Really, again, how much zinc should you take? Check your charts for your age, your age and your sex, or ask your family doctor. The last one that's all over the place is vitamin C. Man, if you search vitamin C in Google, don't do that. You're going to get vitamin C ads on Facebook within seconds. So vitamin C is something called ascorbic acid, and it's found in all of your fruits and vegetables. So it's one of those things that people would get scurvy from the lack of vitamin C when they were traveling in ships long distances, because none of their fruits and vegetables would be kept long enough. So their teeth would fall out and things like that. It's definitely important for your immune function. But can you ward off sickness and illness by taking doses of vitamin C? Preventing colds with vitamin C, there's really little or any data that shows that if you take vitamin C supplements, that it's really going to help you out at all. Vitamin C is fairly safe to take. It's really cheap. Like, it's a water-soluble vitamin, so if the more you take of it, you just pee it out. So if you're deficient in vitamin C, it can only help you. But there's really weak evidence for colds that it's going to help you with that. But with viruses, maybe a little different. Some small studies from July in Nutrition found that vitamin C may prevent infections and tamp down the dangerous inflammatory reaction that causes some of the severe symptoms with coronavirus. So, I mean, that's promising. This is more for like the severe stuff, like pneumonia. Just warding off getting it, very unlikely. So there's not enough evidence to know whether vitamin C is helpful to take or not helpful to take. I guess if you're going to be safe, vitamin C is probably the least risky to take and worry about taking too much. The other fat-soluble ones, like especially vitamin D, you can take too much of that. So again, with vitamin C, check your charts and ask your family doctor. So that's just a little bit about coronavirus. We're talking about it on this week's podcast because in Canada, we're seeing an explosion of growth. Last week, I believe there was more daily cases over a 3-day period, then almost the height, the worst that Canada ever went through, like back in April and May, like the peak of coronavirus in Canada. So, and misinformation flies when people get scared. That being said, remdesivir, vitamin C, vitamin D, zinc, your best defense against coronavirus is three things: wear a mask, don't gather, and wash your hands. That's science news for this week. This week in Pet Science, we're going to take a look at a study about dogs and their selection or non-selection for human faces that has been making the rounds on social media. We've had a lot of people direct messaging and emailing the podcast about the study, so we'll just go into it a little bit. It's pretty complicated if you go to the actual journal article because they get into the nitty-gritty of how they tested. So we'll just parse out what the study was. Anybody that owns a dog would like to think that your dog knows who you are based on when they look at your face, that they can recognize your face. And spoiler alert, the study basically concludes that dogs could care less what your face looks like, which means there's probably a lot of other things at play that is outside the realm of human experience to explain how dogs interact with their family members. I've read that dogs can sniff out their humans within a crowd of people quite easily, or even the shape and the movement of their family members, not necessarily the specific parts of their body, but the overall shape and how they move. So for dogs versus humans and how we as humans key in on faces, and even for primates, a group of researchers wanted to take a look at, did that actually occur? Do dogs actually key in on faces as often as humans do. So this study had a small group of dogs who were all really well trained because the dogs had to sit and look at a picture that they were shown, a stimulus picture, and all stimulus pictures were shown to the dogs and the humans for the same amount of time. But they also had to have a neural image done of their brain. Now, dogs and humans have very similar parts of their brain that light up for recognition, for pleasure, for fear. So the researchers used that previous knowledge to show that if this area of the brain lit up, the dog was keying in on the photo. Just like if that area lit up for a human, the human was keying in on the photo. So of the group of dogs, they were relatively the same age, and they had equal amounts of male and female for the most part. The humans were also homogenous too, the humans that were chosen. So a picture was shown to both humans and dogs, and the picture was one of four possibilities. It was a human face without makeup or jewelry, the back of a human head, so like the back of your head, a dog face, and the back of a dog head. And then right after that was shown, the scan was taken to see which areas of the brain were impacted, if any at all. And it might come as, it might be a little sad to know that dogs and humans reacted very differently to pictures. The humans reacted to human faces by far the most. That was where the greatest areas of the brain for recognition and pleasure and I guess just kind of neural imaging showed up. Humans that had dogs or have had dogs, when a dog face showed up, they were also very cued into the dog face, more so than humans that had never owned a dog before. But when they looked at the dogs were more interested in other dogs, not so much even the face of a human or the back of a human head. In fact, the dogs were just about equally as excited to see a dog face as the back of a dog. So they were just cued in on anything that looked like a dog. There was way more neural activity for the species of dog than when a dog watched a video of a human or the front of a human or back of a human. Now, the researchers made a couple interesting points is that, you know, dogs didn't evolve to be able to recognize humans. I mean, they've existed on Earth by themselves far longer than they've existed with us. Even though dogs have been in and around humans or genetically selected or selectively bred for maybe as long as 20,000 years ago. So it's a different processing power. Dogs have been keyed, they've evolved to identify other dogs, not necessarily humans. Of course, there was some neural activity when a dog saw a human, or I guess what a human was doing. They found there was greater activity when the human was doing something that looked like action. So they had a couple of just humans being just humans, and then humans maybe doing something else. And the same thing happened actually with humans versus humans. When a human was like lip reading or moving their mouth, people were like, whoa, what are they doing? That's curious. They figured it was something called the novelty effect with dogs. They're like, whoa, that's interesting. What's going on there? So if it was kind of boring, the dogs were like, don't really care. But they were super interested when there was a dog and the dog looked like it was doing something as opposed to just being there. But even if the dog was there, there was more neural activity. So the conclusion is that our dogs identify us much differently than we think they do. When a dog looks at us, and we think they're identifying our face, they could be, but they're identifying other things about us. They're more interested in identifying the face of another dog than human faces around them. There's a lot of research going into like some kind of smell test that dogs' powerful sense of smell shapes their experience of their life, just like our processing power through vision shapes the experience of our life. And I guess that's what makes dogs and humans so very different. And while we are very different, our skill sets complement each other so well. Yes, dogs maybe can't recognize faces like humans can, but man, can dogs recognize odors. So take heart. When your dog looks at you, I'm pretty sure they love you, but maybe they're recognizing you more by your smell. And if you've trained them to do focus, like we're working on with Beaker, Bunsen's really good at, but that's one of the things that Beaker's working on in obedience dog classes is to maintain eye contact. That's really hard for dogs to do. Our dog trainer for Bunsen, and it's with the same outfit in Red Deer, they say some dogs really struggle with eye contact. They don't like to do it because it's super weird for them. I often wonder now after reading the study what Bunsen was thinking when I made him stare into my eyes. Was he doing it to get a reward? Was he analyzing my face and my eyes? When he looks at me, am I just a blur? I think those unanswered questions about our canine companions just open up more areas of study, and I love that part about science. That's Pet Science for this week. Hi, science enthusiasts. If you've been listening to the podcast and you really enjoy the content, consider signing up as a patron on our Patreon page. The podcast isn't free to produce, and our patrons make everything so much easier and even possible. We have many tiers of support. If you head over to www.patreon.com/Bunsenburner, you can see all the cool perks each different level gets. Patrons get patron-only content, early pictures of Bunsen, insight into running the podcast, shoutouts at the end, and really cool swag. Consider signing up to support the show. The other way you can support the show is to head over to the Bunsen website. There you'll find all manner of adorable merch and limited quantities of the Bunsen stuffy. They may be sold out by the time you listen to this. We use the proceeds of that to help promote the podcast, increase equipment, and push content of science, empathy, and cuteness everywhere. You'll find the link to the Patreon page and the website in the show notes. Thanks for listening. Now on to the interviews. On the Science Podcast in the Ask an Expert section, I am super delighted to have Emily Calandrelli with me today. How are you doing today, Emily?
Hi, thanks for having me.
A couple of questions we ask right off the bat is, where in the world are you calling into the podcast from?
Yes, I am calling from San Jose, California.
A little bit further south than we are up here in Alberta, Canada.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And are you and your family doing okay with coronavirus? It's like all over the world right now, and it kind of is tying everybody together.
Yes. I mean, it's definitely been interesting for sure. But I would say having a one-year-old makes that quarantine process a little bit more entertaining than it would be otherwise. So we're holding in there.
I'm wondering what would be more busy. We got a puppy during quarantine, Beaker, our golden retriever, or a one-year-old. I think they're maybe equally as
probably
destructive when
similar.
They start moving.
Yeah.
So, Emily, there are so many cool things that you've done so far. We'll get to some of them in a second, but could you tell everybody a little bit about your education and maybe a couple of your projects up till, I guess, recently that you've been involved with, in case people really don't know that much about you?
Yeah. So as you said, I'm Emily Calandrelli online. I'm known as the Space Gal, and that's mostly because of my background in education. I got two bachelor's degrees in mechanical and then in aerospace engineering. And then I went to MIT for my master's. I got one in aeronautics and astronautics, and then a second one in something called technology and policy. And today I'm a science communicator on various platforms. So the main thing right now is that I am a host and executive producer, or co-executive producer rather, on a show on Netflix called Emily's Wonder Lab, which I'm really excited about.
And so good.
It's so cool. And then I am an executive producer and host of a show on Fox called Exploration Outer Space. I'm a correspondent for Bill Nye on his Netflix show, Bill Nye Saves the World. And then I'm an author of a children's chapter book series, The Ada Lace Adventures.
Man, could you do more stuff? That's insane.
Well, you know, it's nice when you get to work on different projects every other year, and then all those projects just kind of add up after a while.
So a couple questions for you about your education. You have all of these multiple degrees and master's and a couple master's degrees. Did I get that right?
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So for people who are listening and they hear that, did you have to go to school like for a double the length to get to, or were you able to team up some classes and have them apply? Just, we have some people mm-hmm. who are currently working on their master's right now that listen.
Yeah, that's such a good question. And I mean, it's the reason that I got multiple ones is because the classes overlapped. So as you might imagine, in mechanical engineering and aerospace engineering, there's a lot of engineering classes that overlap. And so what's really nice is that I only had to go to school for an additional year, a year's worth of classes to get a full second degree. And then when I did my master's, you only needed, for the one that I did at MIT, you only needed to write one thesis. And so the coursework only took about a year and a half to complete. And so I was able to do two master's in 3 years.
I'm not trying to like poo-poo your amazing education.
It's
I was just super curious when, like when you mentioned that, similar to like me personally, I'm a high school chemistry teacher. I've got a science degree in chemistry, an undergrad, and then I was only 2 years to get my other undergrad for education. Mm, so some of the classes, I mean, I don't have master's degrees.
No, but you get it. I mean, it feels so like you're kind of, like gaming the system a little bit. You're like, I can leave here with 2 degrees and only an extra couple years. Like, that's not too bad.
It's almost a BOGO.
Yeah, it's almost a BOGO. A BOGO for degrees.
No, not quite. So when the other thing that people are really interested about the guests that we've had is, man, you are just entrenched so deeply and so passionately in science and space. Where did that start for you?
Yeah, so I have a little bit of a different start than I have heard from a lot of my peers in this world who maybe had family members who were scientists or engineers or worked at NASA. I didn't know anybody that was in the world of STEM. I'm the first person in my family to pursue a degree in STEM. My dad was the first person in his family to go to college. Like there's a lot of firsts and that legacy, and we kind of are just feeling our way through this, not really knowing what we're doing. But for me, I was a very practical high school student. I knew that I wanted to get a good job and I knew that I liked math. And so I kind of Googled all of the majors one could major in college, and I looked at their starting salaries. And I learned that, you know, engineers, people who studied engineering often had some of the highest starting salaries after a 4-year degree. And I knew that engineers used a lot of math. And so I put those two together and I thought, okay, the next 4 years of my life are going to be really hard and maybe not so fun, but I'm going to end up with a good job. Mm-hmm. But what I learned is that I loved this stuff. I reluctantly joined, but I enthusiastically stayed. I discovered all of these wonderful adventures that students can have when they're studying STEM, from flying in the Vomit Comet to designing and building a greenhouse in Mexico, through Engineers Without Borders, through paid internships in California and in China. I mean, I got to travel the world and get paid to do it because I was a student studying STEM. And I found this wonderful passion for this stuff. And so to this day, I try to share that passion with others.
That's awesome. So up here in Canada, not everybody has Fox. And you have that big TV show on Fox, Exploration Outer Space. Mm-hmm. And where a lot of people on social media, I guess you kind of like rocketed to everybody's smartphones, was you were doing all these cool experiments during the pandemic shutdown. And were you kind of in between TV shows, or were you having downtime yourself? And then you decided to shoot these really fun experiments, because that's where a lot of even my high school students know you from.
Yes, that's exactly right. So when the pandemic happened, all of my jobs got canceled. And so the entire filming of my show got put on pause. All my speaking events got canceled, like just everything, because all of my work requires travel. And so all of those events either got paused indefinitely or just weren't going to happen. And so me doing science experiments on social media, that came out of a little bit of boredom and a little bit of anxiety of like, oh my gosh, what am I going to do with my career now? How am I going to make money? And so I kind of put that anxiety and creativity to work to create something that, you know, when we get to the other side of this, I will hopefully have maybe a new YouTube channel or a new TikTok account that I can hopefully monetize after this is all said and done. And so I just spent like 4 to 6 hours a day reading about science experiments and writing new science experiments and publishing new videos on these science experiments on YouTube and now on TikTok. And it's been really fun. It's gone really well. And it's definitely been something very productive to be able to do with my time during this weird quarantine era.
So you're not like the most of my students and other people that when everything shut down, when was that, like February, March, you weren't like binge watching The Tiger King and other awful Netflix shows.
I also did that.
You did that too?
Yes, I did. That was my evening activity.
I don't want to say awful, just like, you know, less educational. Well, I guess it was pretty educational, wasn't it?
Yeah, there's some bits of education in there for sure.
Now, speaking of Netflix, you have this show on Netflix called Emily's Wonder Lab, and it is like 90% adorable science and 10% just like so much enthusiasm in the show. We have many people that listen who have small children, and they would just be so curious if you could talk to us, and they're so thankful if you could talk to us briefly about what brought the show together. Like, how did that happen?
Oh my gosh, yeah. So Emily's Wonder Lab, for those of you who haven't seen it, it's on Netflix. There's 10 episodes. Each episode is only about 10 minutes. And each episode has one larger-than-life science experiment. So think a pool filled with slime where kids get to make the slime, learn what slime is, and then they get to swim in the slime. And then at the end of each episode, it's just me in my lab, and I show you an at-home science experiment that you could do with materials that you have lying around your house. And so it's a really fun way to bring the science from the show into your own kitchen, into your own living rooms. And so I love that. So the way that it became, the way it came to be was that I wanted to do a science show for kids for a number of years. We've been pitching, a show for kids for like 4 or 5 years, myself and my producer friend, Maria Pepin from Buena Murray. And it just, we got it to the pilot stage at another network. And then we got feedback that it was going to be too sciencey for their audience. Which was a little bit disappointing just because I think that the world needs a bit more science. And I thought
I think we could bring the rigor up there, hey, in many places in our lives.
Yeah. I mean, I think that we have a lot of problems today because too many people shied away from science.
Oh my goodness.
I was really thankful that a platform like Netflix welcomed us in, and we kind of created the show with them. And it's just been a dream come true to see it come to life.
I'm going to imagine the planning was like pretty insane for some of the things you did. Like just, okay, for example, the swimming pool full of slime. Did you have like stunt coordinators around there when I'm just curious about the logistics of it, or is that a trade secret? You don't want to tell us you have a slime wrangler or something like that.
I mean, the fun part about choosing the science experiments was that I would go to a coffee shop every day and just scour the internet looking for different science experiments. And then we would ask the question, how do we make this bigger? How do we make this colorful? How do we make this, maybe into a game that the kids could play? And so it was really fun to have kind of the production value that you would expect in a Netflix show and apply those to science experiments for kids. So that was really fun. And then, of course, to create all this stuff, you need a lot of brave production assistants who are willing to test it out and clean it up afterwards. And I'm very thankful to the crew that we had who were willing.
So you had somebody that they just hucked into the go in there, guy, see how it goes.
Yeah, exactly. And then let's see how long this takes to mix. Can we actually do this live can we do this within a few minutes? And so all of these things with timing are really important, because if there was an experiment that would maybe take overnight to complete, then we just weren't going to be able to do it. So we had to be very selective about which science experiments we chose.
And all of the kids on the show, they obviously were probably cast, but it just seems like they were pretty authentic in how much fun they were having. Did you find that?
Oh my gosh, yes. And I think that's the case with like any child. I think any child, if you take the science experiments from the show that we chose, they're going to get so amped to be able to do those. That was the magic of the show, is we specifically chose science experiments that any kid would love. And my favorite part about the show was that we didn't tell the kids what they were going to see that day. They came into the Wonder Lab just being like, what is Emily going to have for us today? And it was so fun to see their anticipation and their excitement and all of those reactions that you see on the show. Those are totally genuine. We didn't tell them what was going to happen. That's like exactly how they reacted to the science. And that's the part that I love the most.
Oh my goodness. I'm just smiling from ear to ear, just picturing these kids just vibrating with excitement. They might've been so excited. They flubbed the little lines or things that are just like, hey, how you're feeling? They're like, blah, blah, blah. They just can't even handle it.
I mean, that's exactly right. 'Cause like they didn't have lines prior to us filming. Of course, like after the reaction, we might have to like go back to a kid and have the camera on them to re-say what they said so that we can get a close-up of it or something. But like, this is a very unscripted show. This is the kids actually being the kids. Every once in a while, we'll have like a cheesy line that they say to camera. But for the most part, this is just them reacting to science.
I love it. Pre-COVID, I travel around the central part of our province. I get leave from my school to do these science assemblies for elementary school kids. And my favorite one is the big liquid nitrogen explosion where you pour liquid nitrogen into the boiling water and it makes that giant cloud. And the kids are safely back, but they lose their mind. Like that is, it is, if you kind of feel like a rock star or somebody, you know, I just poured liquid nitrogen. That's all I did. And these kids are losing their mind. So did you get a bit of that too, that you just felt, oh my goodness, this is such good work that we're doing. If they're having this much fun in studio, it's going to impact kids at home.
I mean, yes. And I think even more so than the kids, like I was having fun. I was like, this is the coolest thing. I mean, there are a few in there that I'd been wanting to do for years, but just didn't have the resources to do it. Like, I think it's the second episode we did Oobleck, which is just cornstarch and water. And it makes that like very cool, gooey, gacky liquid that sometimes feels like a liquid. Sometimes it feels like a solid. And I wanted to, for many years, create an entire pool filled with Oobleck. Pools of stuff is a very common theme in this show. But I wanted to create a pool of it because as you see in the show, if you kind of walk across a pool of Oobleck in a certain way, you can walk on top of it and not sink. And it's just this really unique challenge. It's kind of like quicksand, where like if you move in quicksand, you change its properties. And quicksand, when you move in it, it becomes more like a liquid. But when you stay still, it feels more like a solid. Oobleck is similar, but opposite. When you move on Oobleck, it makes it feel like a solid. But when you stand still on Oobleck, it makes it feel like a liquid. So Oobleck is like the opposite of quicksand, in that to survive it, you actually need to move really, really fast.
That's hilarious. That's awesome. And I'd imagine you had testers test it out so you didn't lose a kid in the swimming pool.
And that's true. Well, the swimming pool was only about like a foot and a half deep. So we definitely took precautions, but
I'm just teasing. Have you ever put Oobleck on a giant speaker? That's a fun one. Like,
so we tested that out on the show, but we couldn't get it to work. So, well, I'll have to talk to somebody else who had done that successfully, because I think there maybe we didn't have the right type of speaker or like a powerful enough speaker, but we couldn't get it to move like the videos I'd seen.
Oh yeah, it's tricky. It took me a while to find like a big bass speaker, and then you had to get, so I think it's a frequency thing. I'm not a physics guy, so I was just using random samples from the internet, and I found it was like ultra dubstep, and then that worked. So,
ultra dubstep. So, I'll have to write that down for possibly season two.
Some of the kids listen to dubstep, and it's literally like, I don't know, if you took 30 different instruments into an abandoned building and threw them against the walls, you'd eventually get dubstep. So that's, maybe that affects the Oobleck some way. So I'm not, I don't know.
Okay, cool.
One more question about your show. It's first season's on Netflix. Is there any plans for a second season?
Oh my gosh, we are fighting for one so hard. So I cannot emphasize this enough. When people like a show like this, you have to tell your friends to watch it. Because for this in particular, I'm so excited, because I think anyone who has seen it has loved it. We just need to get it into more schools and into more living rooms. We just need more people to watch it. So we are very hopeful for a season two, but we need to make sure that everyone and everyone and everyone and everyone and everyone is watching it.
Well, we'll make sure personally for myself that our school district up here in Canada, it's going to be sent. This podcast will be sent out to the elementary school students, so they'll know, and the teachers will know about the show if they didn't know about it before. So
perfect.
We don't have a lot. We don't have a lot of population up here, but I think every little bit helps.
It does.
Before we move on to the super fact, I was hoping I could just ask you a quick question about your book series. That your book series that you have, Ada Lace. No,
that's yes. Right. Yeah, Ada Lace Adventures.
Could you tell everybody just a little bit about that if they want to look for these books someplace?
Yeah. So the Ada Lace Adventures is all about a girl named Ada. She's in third grade who loves science and technology, and she goes on adventures to solve mysteries with tech and gadgets that she actually builds herself. And it's just such a fun series. It's kind of a book that I wish that I had when I was growing up. And there's 5 books in the series now.
It's just more of a girl role model who is using her brains over brawn in situations.
That's right. Yep. Her and her best friend Nina solve mysteries together using science and technology and creativity and art sometimes.
There you go. You know what it kind of reminds me of? I don't know if you ever watched the old Inspector Gadget cartoon. Mm-hmm. But literally Penny, the niece, always saved Inspector Gadget's bacon. Like without her, this guy was hopelessly just hooped every single show. And I don't know why they didn't just make her the main character, like have Inspector Gadget be the sidekick. That's what
I was watching. Or at least have like a spinoff show.
Yeah. Yeah. Penny saves the day and Inspector Gadget stays at home. Like that's something like that. All right. Well, thanks for talking to us about your cool show on Netflix. And if people don't know how to find it, they'll be able to look for it now on Netflix, and we'll have a link to it in the show notes of the podcast.
Perfect.
Yay. The next question we always ask guests about is a pet story, because we kind of meld science and animals on the podcast. We always ask our guests to share a pet story with us. Do you have a pet story you could share today?
Yes, I do. So let's see. When I was in graduate school, I had left home. I had left West Virginia, where I was from, to go move in to Boston in Massachusetts. And I was there long enough that I hadn't realized that my license had expired. And a fun fact is that when your license expires, or at least this is what the case in West Virginia, but when your license expires and you don't renew it in time, you have to retake both the permit test and the driving test.
And really?
So, yes. And so here I am. I would say 23, 24 years old, and I'm getting my master's from MIT. Like, I think I'm pretty hot stuff at the moment. And so I go back home to West Virginia, and I am like, I don't need to study for my permit test. This is something I took when I was 15 and passed. Why would anyone need to study for this? Mm-hmm. And so I go back home to take this test. And this is the exact same time when my dad and mom had gotten a new puppy. They had this new golden retriever puppy.
Oh.
And golden retriever puppies are just the best kind of puppies. They are the cutest floofy floofs. I love them. They're the sweetest things. And so I go back home. I get encouragement from our puppy, Bailey. I go to the DMV. I take the test and I fail it. I walk out with all of the other 15-year-olds excited to tell their parents that they have their permit. And I am going home with my tail between my legs, telling my mom, let's go, let's go, let's go, let's go, let's go. And so I'm so embarrassed. I'm really disappointed in myself that I didn't think I needed to study for this. And I go home to our new puppy, Bailey, and I will just never forget how much better that puppy made me feel when I got into the kitchen and I was just like playing on the kitchen floor with the puppy. And I don't know, he just made me kind of feel a lot better about myself. And I think that's one of the things that puppies and dogs tend to do, is that they tend to remind you to be kind to yourself and be nice to yourself. And so the other part of that story is that the other fun fact about West Virginia is that you need to wait 2 weeks in between times you take your test. Oh, no. And so I had to fly back to Boston knowing that I did not pass my test. And then 2 weeks later, I had to fly back home to retake the test that I now studied for, passed, and finally got to renew my driver's license back home. And the key part of the story is that I had to go back home to take this test because I really wanted to keep my West Virginia driver's license because I'm really proud about being from the state of West Virginia. And I just didn't want to lose that last part of my West Virginia-ness. So instead of just retaking it in Boston, which would have made way more sense, I flew back home so I could see my puppy again and get my West Virginia license.
That's awesome. What a great story. So you're walking out of the place saying, you know what? I've been learning how to send things into outer space and I just didn't quite get through this test here.
Yeah. I mean, it really goes to show you can't really think you're too smart. You will be humbled very quickly when you do.
Oh, I would fail our driver's test here in Alberta in a second without studying. I was looking, like my son, was taking his learner. So I'm not sure the difference in the States versus Canada. Mm-hmm. But when you turn 13, you can get a learner's permit and then drive with a parent or drive with somebody's.
Something similar. Yeah.
You have to pass a little test. And he's like, well, what does this sign do? And I'm like, I have never seen that sign before in my life. That sign says, watch out for the sketchy rock. I don't know what that is.
So. I know. They're hard. You really have to, it'll be like, how many feet do you need to stop behind a stop school bus? And it'll be like 200, 201, 203. And it's like, okay, this is silly. You clearly had to memorize that number.
Oh, that would, I guess, well, you grew up with the feet and pound system, but you would have been learning metric and mostly in your MIT classes, I'd imagine.
I know. In engineering, they do work with metric, which is much better. It's a much easier and more intuitive unit system for sure.
Yeah, I was just thinking that would also bamboozle you on a test if you had to go between metric and imperial. Mm-hmm. I know we have Americans that come up to Canada and they're like, wow, you can drive so fast up here. And they get pulled over because they're going 100 miles per hour.
Oh my gosh.
But it's 100 kilometers an hour. So,
yep.
Because the cars down there don't have kilometers sometimes if they're older on the speedometer.
Yeah.
And then conversely, Canadians go down to the States and they're kind of clueless and they're driving way too slow. It's like 60.
Aww.
Who goes 60? That's very cool. Slow. Well, thanks for sharing your pet story. That's adorable. Yeah. I love that name, Bailey. That's such a classic.
Such a good one.
Classic, adorable golden retriever name.
Yeah.
The other question we ask our guests for is a super fact, something that you know, it could be a story or a fact that when you tell people, it kind of like blows their mind a bit. Do you have a super fact you could share with us?
Yeah, I think, I have a couple, but the one that I always find so funny is that this is just something that people don't often think about, but on the International Space Station, there are astronauts that need to go to the restroom and they go in the toilet like you or I. They have a special toilet, but that all of their waste gets collected and eventually they put it into a capsule that ends up burning up in our atmosphere. That's the way that they get rid of trash on the International Space Station. They put it all in a capsule and then eventually they throw that capsule back at Earth. That capsule ends up burning up in the atmosphere. So I think what's fun to realize is that some of the shooting stars that we see at night are really astronaut poop burning up in our atmosphere. And I just think that's really hilarious and something that we don't often think about. But I hope the next time you see a shooting star, you'll think, huh, that might be astronaut poop.
Oh, my goodness. So if you make a wish on that star, does your wish turn out crappy?
It might turn out a little bit crappy. That's right. but maybe a more fun and real one is that everything that you see in the night sky, I mean, everything you see in general is like this, but the things that you see in the night sky, like the stars, are often many light years away, sometimes millions of light years away. And what that means is that it takes the light from that star millions of years to go from where that star is to our eye, millions of years. And so by looking at that star, we're really seeing how that star existed a million years in the past. We're constantly looking at that star as it existed a million years ago. So I like to think of astronomy and the work that astronomers do as time traveling. Astronomers are really time travelers of space because they're looking at things at how they existed in the past. And that just seems so cool to me.
I love that. Thanks for sharing that the fact. It's mind-blowing, isn't it? Like when you tell that to people who have little science background, can you see like the gears in their eyes just kind of getting bigger, or like kids when you tell that to the first time?
Oh, yeah. Because at first when you hear that, it sounds confusing and you kind of have to really explain it a couple times for them to get it. But then you bring it closer and you're like, the sun, even our sun is a star, and that light from that star takes a little while to reach our eye. It takes 8 minutes from the light from our sun to go from the sun to our eye. So the sun itself is, we're seeing it as it existed 8 minutes in the past. And what that means is that if something were to happen to our star, like if we could just turn our sun off, and just turn it completely off, we wouldn't know that that sun turned off for 8 minutes, because it would take that long for the light or the lack of light to reach our eye.
That's insane. Well, let's hope that doesn't happen, because I'd imagine that some very bad things would follow that.
Yeah, that wouldn't be good.
One of the things I've told students before in grade 9 in Alberta, I sometimes teach grade 9, or high school's grade 9 to 12. I'm not sure what that's in the States. You guys have like sophomore and senior and some kind of like hierarchy system like that.
Yeah.
We have grade 9 to 12. So I don't know. But anyways, when the kids first come to high school in our curriculum, there's a space unit. That's the only time kids get to really learn about space, which is a little disappointing because it's such a cool area. But one of the things we tell kids at our school, which is kind of fun, is like and you can correct me if I'm wrong, maybe I've been teaching this incorrectly, but if, let's say, an alien civilization millions and millions and millions and millions of light years away had technology to observe the Earth with some crazy telescope, they would actually be looking at the dinosaurs or something similar to that, because that light would take so long to get to their eyes.
Yes, that's exactly right. Oh, that's such a fun way. I haven't explained it in that way, but I love that way of explaining it. That's such a good, a way better way to explain how light travels. I love it.
And conversely, if we ever had, you know, I'll be an old man with like the fourth generation of like the Webb telescope, whatever's like coming up in the next 30 or 40 years, if it does take pictures of another, you know, exoplanet and there's stuff orbiting that, that's, you know, potentially millions of years old as well. So
that's exactly right. Yeah.
It's going to be confusing.
Yes, it will.
Well, thanks for sharing your super fact. That's great. Mind-blowing for sure. Mm-hmm. So I just have one more question before we get to the last one. If you have time, I was just wondering, because you are a science communicator and also really schooled in aerospace and aerospace, and you've worked quite a bit with science communication with space, do you still get lots of enjoyment out of those space shows, or does part of your brain like pick them apart as you're watching them, like space movies and things like that?
Yeah, no, I mean, I just, like anyone else, I love a good trashy show. And so I have a lot of guilty pleasures that I, in TV shows that, like, I don't really expect them to have a high bar for science accuracy. And so I think I'm a bit more lenient than most people when they watch space shows. My brain definitely registers like, oh, there's no gravity button. That doesn't make sense. You can't actually do that. But I allow a certain creative license in the shows and movies that I watch. And that doesn't really get to me. I still find it super entertaining.
That's awesome. So aside from Emily's Wonder Lab, what's one of your favorite shows on Netflix or on TV that's space related?
That's space related. I started watching Away, and I liked Away. Who's the kid that says danger, danger, Will Robinson, or the robot? What's that one? What's that series?
Oh, Lost in Space.
Lost in Space. Oh, I love that series. I find it so charming and just cute and fun and exciting. Lost in Space is probably my favorite one that I've actually watched. I have a hard time watching a lot of space movies and shows because I deal with space so much in my work life that in my free time, I'm not usually drawn to like space content. But Lost in Space was one of those really good shows that felt more like entertainment, and had a great storyline, and just the characters were really cute. and I loved them. So that would be my favorite probably.
That's funny. You know, that I can imagine that. I guess there's way more space shows than there is chemistry shows. I loved Breaking Bad. You know, I'm a chemist.
Oh, yeah.
So I love Breaking Bad. I'm like, hey, Walter White is like me without healthcare.
oh my gosh.
That's yeah. exactly. That was the joke in Canada, is like a Canadian teacher gets cancer. Hi, I need treatment. Shows over first episode.
Oh, how funny. I didn't even think about that. See, like in the States, that plot line just
made
makes so much sense. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. The poor guy doesn't have healthcare and he's got to like do some super sketchy stuff and then goes down the rabbit hole of being evil. But I imagine if there's a million different chemistry shows, I'd have to be, you know, I'd get sick of it too.
Yeah.
But that's cool. My wife and I have been watching Away. It's pretty good. I don't know about the, you know, how accurate their spacey space stuff is. Mm-hmm. But I think it's the interpersonal relationships, which are pretty cool.
Yeah, that's right.
One of the last questions we ask guests is one that they get to lead themselves. It could be a cause or something they're really passionate about. You would like to talk about an organization, that you, have, that you would like to everybody to know about. Could you talk to us about that?
Yeah, that's right. So an organization that I love is called the Brooke Owens Fellowship. And the Brooke Owens Fellowship is for women and gender minorities who want to work in the aerospace industry. And it's really just a way to provide more support for like women and non-binary folk who are students and undergrad who want to work in this aerospace industry. And it gives you a paid internship at one of the leading space companies or aerospace companies. And then it gives you a mentor in the field. And so I'm one of the mentors. So I help with this organization by participating as a mentor. And every year I'm paired with a Brookie. That's what they call their fellowships, their fellows in the program, a Brookie. And it's just, it's a really, really cool organization. And I think it's doing a lot of good.
That's awesome. Do you maintain relationships with these people as they go through it, like once they're done?
Oh, definitely. I mean, and they're all doing such incredible things. This fellowship is kind of bringing together the future leaders of the aerospace industry. And so it's nice to be able to see them year after year and have the fellowship grow year after year. It's only been around for 5 years, but they have just been doing leaps and bounds to make their mark on the aerospace industry.
That's awesome. Is there a website that people could be directed to, or if they just Google Brooke Owens Fellowship, they'd find it?
Yeah, it's brookeowensfellowship.org.
.org? Okay. So everybody listening, that'll be in the show notes. You're one click away from finding out more about that organization. Thanks so much for sharing that with us, Emily. And you know what? Thanks. I know you're so busy. We're kind of at the time of the end of our interview. Thanks so much for agreeing to be on the Science Podcast. Emily's Wonder Lab is literally probably the best show to fit kind of the whole Bunsen and Beaker. I don't know if you know about Bunsen and Beaker, our dogs on social media, but our tagline for them is science, empathy, and cuteness. And that's literally what your show is. It's got lots of empathy, lots of science, and it's super cute.
Thanks. That's the best description.
It just oozes enthusiasm. And being a teacher myself and seeing that spark within kids, you see that in those kids in the show. And I can't imagine that it spreads to people that watch it. So that's so great.
Yeah, we definitely hope so.
Well, thanks for talking to us, Emily. Have yourself a great day. And we hope we get a season 2. We'll make sure we get the word out so lots of people watch Emily's Wonder Lab.
Awesome. Thanks for having me on.
Hey, everybody. I just want to give a quick shout out to our sponsor, Genius Lab Gear. Genius Lab Gear is giving everybody 10% off everything at their store if you use the code BUNSEN10. That's BUNSEN 10. Genius Lab Gear has a ton of cool stuff. We love that they sent Bunsen a bandana that says PhD Emotional Support Dog. It's so cute. Also, they have these little wallet-sized stencils for doing organic molecules. And if you're not a scientist or a science teacher, there's gear at the site that you would like as well, including Science is for Everyone stickers and a whole bunch of other stuff. Check them out. That's at geniuslabgear.com. It's time for Woo or Wow on the Science Podcast, and I have Gideon Kidd with me from I've Pet That Dog. How are you doing today, Gideon?
Good.
I'm super excited to have you on the program again, Gideon. And before we get to Woo or Wow, I have a couple fun questions that people might want to know about. You have an adorable book coming out right away, or maybe it's already out.
Yes. If I remember right, it just came out tomorrow.
Yesterday,
sorry.
So that's October 19th.
Yes.
Super exciting. What's the book about?
It's about how to care for your dog. It teaches you all about dogs.
Is this from all of the data you've gathered from your quote unquote scientific experiments in petting dogs over the years?
Yes.
I love it.
And it's illustrated, correct?
Yes.
So do you agree with how the artist has drawn you as a cartoon?
I really do. It's kind of awesome to have a little cartoon me.
Oh, that's amazing. I was thinking of that, how cool that would be.
Did you ask the illustrator if they could make you fly or give you extra muscles?
Sadly not. I had not even thought about that.
Oh, really? Oh, for next time then, right?
Yes, of course.
For next time.
And where can people find this book?
Basically at bookstores or like an Amazon, stuff like that.
Okay, so it's on Amazon.
Yes.
Oh, okay, awesome.
In the show notes, everybody, I'll have a link that you can click that will take you to at least one location where the book is. Oh, and what's the name of the book?
Pet That Dog.
Pet That Dog. That's adorable.
Thanks.
Hey, Gideon, another question I have for you is, how's online school going?
Pretty good. I thought it would be kind of confusing, but it's actually a lot like normal school besides that we can't really see anybody. We still have like online classes and stuff, but it's just everything is online instead of in person.
Do your teachers shoot videos you have to watch every day?
Yes.
And do they make terrible jokes like me sometimes?
Sometimes.
That's great.
What's your favorite subject for online learning, Gideon?
I am really liking world studies.
So like different countries of the world?
Yes.
And the last time we talked, you talked about how much you like Minecraft. And Minecraft just seems to grow. It seems to get bigger and bigger. And I know in the video game world, there was a big announcement of one of the characters from Minecraft is in a new video game. Did you catch that?
Well, there's two others. I thought there was like Minecraft Dungeons.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And then Minecraft Earth. Yeah.
Yeah.
Those are the only two ones that I know about.
Right. But the character from Minecraft is in another video game.
Oh, yes. Yeah, Super Smash Bros.
Yeah. Have you played him in Super Smash Bros. Or have you seen the videos?
Not yet. No. I really want to.
My son and I play Smash Bros. And we got Steve the other day. And I don't know much about Minecraft, but he is super weird. He is a bizarre character to be in that game.
I can imagine.
You can be a zombie or an Enderman, you know, like the scary guys with like the long arms.
That's cool.
It's pretty weird seeing Mario fight an Enderman. I think that's bizarre.
Yes, I think it would be too.
Okay, well, let's get on with Woor Wow. So for everybody at home and a reminder for Gideon, Woor Wow works this way. I'll read three statements, two of them are fake, and only one is true. And Gideon, you have to find the true statement. It's a wow.
Okay, cool.
And the category this week, because I got to speak with Emily Calandrelli, a.k.a. that space gal, is all about space.
Awesome. You ready for the first statement?
Yes.
The first statement.
The sun is the biggest fire in our solar system. And the heat that fire releases keeps our planet nice and warm.
Okay, that's cool. That's statement one. I hear your dog in the background.
Yeah.
What's your dog's name again, Gideon?
Cookie.
That's so cute. Okay, statement two.
In movies, asteroid belts are depicted as having very close rocks together that a pilot has to fly through. In our solar system, the asteroid belt is actually super spread apart, with the rocks in the asteroid belt very far away from each other.
Cool.
The last statement. Just recently, the OSIRIS-REx satellite landed on a moon of Mars, took a sample, blasted off, and is on a 2-year journey back towards us.
I got the first one and the last one. Do you think you could please repeat the second one?
You bet, Gideon. I'll just recap them all, too. The first statement is about the sun being the biggest fire in our solar system, and its heat keeps us warm. The second statement is about how our asteroid belt has the rocks really far apart, And in movies, they're depicted really close together. But in our solar system, they're very, very, very far apart from each other. And the last statement is about the OSIRIS-REx satellite landing on a moon of Mars and taking a sample, blasting off, and coming back towards us.
I'm guessing the first one about the
sun. You think the first one is the true statement?
Yes.
That the sun is the biggest fire in our solar system?
Yes.
Okay, final answer, Gideon.
Yes.
Bum, bum, bum.
Okay, let's take a look at the last statement about OSIRIS-REx. You're right, that's not a true statement. What actually happened is amazing. OSIRIS-REx is a satellite, and it did touch down, sort of, but on an asteroid called Bennu. And Bennu may, in 150 years, come in contact with the Earth. And OSIRIS-REx basically reached out a little arm and booped it and took a sample and is on its way home.
Cool.
Yeah, so not a moon of Mars. Not one of the moons of Mars.
Nice.
Okay, Gideon, that leaves us two statements left. One is about the sun. One is about the asteroid belt. Which one do you want to hear first?
Asteroid.
Okay.
Okay, Gideon, the asteroid statement is... Oh, I'm sorry, you weren't correct this time. It is true that in our solar system, the asteroid belt is really spread out far away. I know in movies, it's really fun to watch like Han Solo and other, you know, spaceship pilots zip between different asteroids. But within our solar system, the asteroids are like 200,000 miles apart. So you don't need to be zipping around in that. You have lots of space. And the sun one's not true. It's not a fire on the sun. It's actually something called fusion. The hydrogen atoms are squished so tightly together that they fuse and form another element called helium.
Yeah.
And that releases the energy. So not fire.
Wow.
Well, dang. Hey, well, even though you got it wrong, I think everybody learned something. We got to learn about your new book, and we got to learn about some of the things you're doing for online school. And I think you got to learn a little bit about space, too. So it's a win-win-win. Oh, hey, speaking of, I guess, heat and sun and fire, is it getting cold where you guys are?
We had our first snow a few days ago.
Well, it was so good to chat with you for Woo or Wow, and I hope you come back on again, Gideon. It's a lot of fun to have you.
Yeah, of course. I'd love to.
Well, best of luck with your book, Gideon, and take care.
You too.
Okay, it's time for story time with me. Adam.
Hey, it's time for story time. So story time is a time when we talk about stories that have happened within a timeline. Ooh, the story time timeline of relevancy. So we're going to talk about stories that have happened within the past 1 or 2 weeks or something like that. I'll go first. I don't ever go first, but I'll go first. I had a friend over and we were making cookies, right? They turned out really good. They were really good cookies because,
friend.
What?
A friend.
Stop it. Anyway. I was in charge of making sure that the cookies were okay, which is why they turned out not burnt. So, yeah. Anyway, making cookies, right? It's pretty easy. You have butter, you have your sugar, you have your beaker, your brown sugar. You have your milk, you have your eggs, you have your flour, you have
you
your baking.
Put milk in them.
I didn't put milk in them, but whatever.
Okay.
Anyway, you have your salt. Okay, so I cut the butter in half because that was basically a cup or whatever it said on the thing, which was a cut, and I put it in there, right? And I just set the butter aside, not thinking about anything, right? Anyway, Beaker decided to be sneaky, and she tried to take the butter, but she couldn't because she wasn't fast enough. She wasn't fast or sneaky enough. We could see her head poke up, and we're like, nope. Yeah, but that kind of reminds me of our old dog, Callan, who grabbed butter off of the counter, and we called it dog lick butter because the dog licked it. And she drank out of the toilet, so...
Gross. So it ruined all the
It butter. Ruined the butter. And she got, like, three butters. Dog lick butter. And we actually... at one point, we got new butter, and Callan just took it, and it was gone. And then we had to get more butter. So, yeah, that's my story. Butter, Beaker. Beaker the butter dog. All right. Mom, do you have a story?
I sure do. Okay. Anyway, so what happened was yesterday, Jason was creating the ad for the podcast and time was ticking and it was getting dark. And I actually had taken Beaker to the vet to have her stitches out and she was given a clean bill of health. So we were going to take the dogs on a walk. But we decided because it was getting dark that we were just going to go over the hill and up the hill and just do a short little jaunt. Well, hilarity ensued because I can't find my winter boots. I had them on the other day. Now I cannot find them. So Jason said, just throw on your rubber boots. And I said, okay. Anyway, so we're walking down and the bottom of those are slick. So it was walk slash slide all the way down to the bottom of the creek there. And then there was no way I was making it up the hill. I was falling down. I said, nope.
You couldn't even take a step.
I couldn't even take a step. And so I waited kind of at the bottom. And because it's been cold, the creek is frozen. So I was just walking along and Jason had taken the dogs up and they were up at the top of the hill and then they saw me down there. So they kind of came down and played a little bit with me and were running around and Beaker was so excited to be outside. And then all of a sudden I looked, Beaker looked and flap, 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 flap. Up came the grouse. Well, Christmas came early for Beaker because she was like, what? And she started to run and I'm like, oh no, she's going to chase them and it's going to be terrible. But they were too fast this time. But I said to Jason, I said, hey, do you see that owl? And Jason said, there's no owl here. And I said, yes, there is, up in the tree. And just then it swooped down. It was probably wanting the grouse. And then I thought, ooh, is Beaker big enough that it won't take her? But she was about, I don't know how much bigger than the owl, but she was bigger than the owl. And the owl left her alone. And then she was like, oh, I'm going to go into this area where the grouse were and maybe they'll be back. But they were not back because they had left. And then after that, we walked back and it was slip slide all the way back to the house. And I have a now renewed effort to find my winter boots.
That's not the first encounter we've had with the grouse, but most likely won't be the last. Anyway, Dad, do you have a story?
Yep, my story is we signed Beaker up for dog obedience. So because of COVID, she missed puppy classes. I think she's 6 months, right? Yeah, so normally you would put them in with puppy classes. And because she's had her space, she can join the group classes. And she actually, I think, knows most of the level one skills because she was like super bored. We're like, Beaker, sit. And she's like, I can do that. I'm like, stay. She just had to learn to stay. And because she doesn't really do that great because she's a puppy. But once she figured out she had to stay, it was great. And she could do these things called push-ups where you go down, you sit up and stand. So she had that all perfect. And she's really good at focus, which is like, we weren't supposed to be practicing that, but Beaker was bored. So I was doing focus with her where you like stare at your dog in your eyes and have them lock eye contact with you. She's freakishly good at it. It's actually kind of unnerving because Bunsen struggled with it. He only looks in your eyes for a little bit unless you have a treat. Whereas Beaker will just like stare right into your soul with her cute eyes. So anyways, I think because Beaker was a little bored or she was a little amped up because she wanted to play because she was still like on rest. She saw all these other dogs and was like barking at them. She's like, hey, hello. And then the dogs were like, what? They're like, what is this? They didn't really pay attention to her. It was so weird. She's like, hello, it's me. Hi. And they're like, what are you? And I felt bad for her. But I think she's going to do so good. Because Bunsen trained her. Bunsen's trained her on all of the different things. Like, come sit, stay, get ready, lay down, all of these things. She's a pro at it. But it was really fun to have her in dog obedience class. That's my story.
Both dogs are just kind of chilling. Bunsen is in between my legs because he's a bit of a suck right now. Because, yeah, he's gone now. Anyway. Oh, yeah, Bunsen
took it. Yeah, okay. That was your fault, Beaker. You left it.
No, he can't have it, though.
Okay, that's been story time with me, Adam. Hope you turn in next time to see what happens next time. We might do story time, or we might do some mailbag questions. See you guys later. Bye-bye!
What a fun episode. It was super cool to talk to Emily Calandrelli. So thanks, Emily, for talking to us on the Science Podcast. And also special thanks to Gideon Kidd from I've Pet That Dog for helping with Woo or Wow this week. It's really tough to win Woo or Wow. We'd also like to give a shout out to our top tier patrons on Patreon. Without their support, the podcast wouldn't be where it is today,
and we wouldn't be able to keep it growing. If you want to hear your name at the end of the podcast, head over to the Patreon page and sign up. Our top tier patrons are
Catherine Lynch, Judith Morton, Mary Coos, Marianne McNally, Daniel Fry, Shelby Leggett, Karen Beth St. George, Andrea Persons, Bianca Hyde, Brooke Lavallo, Kathy Zerker, Liz Button, and Ben Rathert.
Let's end with the dog's motto: for science, empathy, and cuteness.